half-tanned groundhog hide. I set down the tray, and Brianna, who had come up with me, stepped forward, her invention carefully held in both hands, like an acolyte presenting bread to a priest. "What in the name of Christ is that?" Jamie frowned at the object, then up at me. "It's a sort of do-it-yourself rattlesnake," Brianna told him. Everyone murmured with interest, craning their necks to see, though the interest was diverted almost at once as I turned back the quilt and began to unwrap his leg, to a chorus of shocked murmurs and sympathetic exclamations at sight of it. Lizzie and Masali had been faithfully applying fresh hot onion and flaxseed poultices to it all day, and wisps of steam rose from the wrappings as I put them aside. The flesh of his leg was bright red to the knee, at least in those parts that weren't black or seeping with pus. We had removed the maggots temporarily, afraid the heat would kill them. They were presently downstairs on a plate in my surgery, happily occupied with some of the nastier bits of the bug's gleanings. If I succeeded in saving the leg, they could help with the tidying up later. I had carefully gone through the detritus bit by bit, examining the blue moulds with my microscope, and putting aside everything that could be identified as bearing penicillium into a large bowl. Over this miscellaneous collection I had poured the fermented corn liquor, allowing the whole to steep during the day, and with luck, to dissolve any actual raw penicillin from the garbage into the alcoholic liquid. Meanwhile, I had made a selection of those herbs with a reputation for the internal treatment of suppurative conditions, and made a stiff decoction of them, steeped in boiling water for several hours. I poured a cup of this highly aromatic solution and handed it to Roger, carefully averting my nose. "Make him drink it," I said. "All of it," I added pointedly, fixing Jamie with a look. Jamie sniffed the proffered cup and gave me the look back, but obediently sipped, making exaggerated faces for the entertainment of his company, who giggled appreciatively. The mood thus lightened. I proceeded to the main event, turning to take the makeshift hypodermic from Bree. The Beardsley twins, standing shoulder to shoulder in the corner, pressed forward to see, swelling with pride. They had gone out at once, at Bree's request, coming back in mid-afternoon with a fine rattlesnake nearly 3 feet long, and fortunately dead, having been cut nearly in half with an axe so as to preserve the valuable head. I had dissected out the poison sacs with great caution, detaching the fangs, and then had put Mrs. Bug to the task of rinsing the fangs repeatedly with alcohol to eradicate any lingering traces of venom. Bree had taken the oiled silk that had been used to wrap the astrolabe, and stitched part of it into a small tube, gathering one end of this with a drawstitch, like a purse string. She had cut a thick segment from a turkey's wing quill, softened with hot water, and used this to join the gathered end of the silk tube to the fang. Melted beeswax had sealed the joints of tube, quill, and fang, and been spread carefully along the line of stitching to prevent leakage. It was a nice, neat job, but it did look quite like a small fat snake, with one enormous curved fang, and occasioned no little comment from the spectators. Murdo Lindsay was still holding one of Jamie's hands. As I motioned to Fergus to hold the candle for me, I saw Jamie reach out the other toward Roger. Roger looked momentarily startled, but grabbed the hand and knelt down by the bed, holding on tight. I ran my fingers lightly over the leg, selected a good spot clear of major blood vessels, swabbed it with pure alcohol, and jabbed the fang in as deeply as I could. There was a gasp from the spectators and a sharp intake of breath from Jamie, but he didn't move. "All right." I nodded at Brianna, who was standing by with a bottle of strained corn alcohol. Teeth sunk in her lower lip, she poured carefully, filling the silk tube as I supported it. I folded the open top tightly over and with thumb and forefinger firmly pressed downward, forcing the liquid out through the fang and into the tissues of the leg. Jamie made a small breathless noise, and both Murdo and Roger leaned inward instinctively, their shoulders pressing against his, holding on. I didn't dare go too fast, for fear of cracking the wax seals by exerting too much pressure. though we had a second syringe made with the other fang, just in case. I worked my way up and down the leg, with Bree refilling the syringe with each injection, and blood rose glistening from the holes as I withdrew the fang, rolling in tiny rivulets down the side of his leg. Without being asked, Lizzie picked up a cloth and blotted it clean, eyes intent on the job. The room was silent, but I felt everyone's breath held as I chose a new spot, let out in a sigh as the stab was made, and then the unconscious leaning toward the bed as I squeezed the stinging alcohol deep into the infected tissues. The muscles stood out in knots on Jamie's forearms, and sweat ran down his face like rain, but neither he, nor Murdo, nor Roger made a sound or moved. From the corner of my eye, I saw Joseph Weems stroke back the hair from Jamie's forehead and wipe away the sweat from his face and neck with a towel.
"Because you need me," he'd said.
And I realized then that it wasn't only me that he'd meant. It didn't take a long time. When it was done, I spread honey carefully over all the open wounds and rubbed oil of wintergreen into the skin of foot and calf.
"That's a nice job of basting, Sasnach. Do you reckon it's ready for the oven yet?" Jamie asked,
and wiggled his toes, causing the tension in the room to relax into laughter. Everyone did leave then, patting Jamie's shoulder or kissing his cheek in farewell with gruff wishes of good luck. He smiled and nodded, lifting his hand in farewell, exchanging goodbyes, making small jokes. When the door closed behind the last of them, he lay back on the pillow and closed his eyes, letting all his breath out in a long, deep sigh. I set about tidying my tray, setting the syringe to soak in alcohol, corking bottles, folding bandages. Then I sat down beside him, and he reached out a hand to me, not opening his eyes. His skin was warm and dry, the hand reddened from Murdo's fierce grip. I traced his knuckles gently with my thumb, listening to the rumble and clatter of the house below, subdued but lively. "It will work," I said softly after a minute. "I know it will."
"I know," he said.
He took a deep breath and at last began to weep. Chapter 94. New Blood. Roger woke abruptly out of a black and dreamless sleep. He felt like a landed fish, jerked gasping into an alien and unimagined element. He saw but didn't grasp his surroundings, strange light and flattened surfaces. Then his mind made sense of Brianna's touch on his arm, and he was once more inside his skin and in a bed.
"Huh?"
He sat up suddenly, making a hoarse noise of inquiry.
"I'm sorry to wake you."
Brianna smiled, but a line of concern drew her brows together as her eyes searched his face. She smoothed the tangled hair back from his brow, and he reached for her by reflex, falling back against the pillow with her heavy in his arms.
"Ah." Oh.
Holding her was an anchor to reality, solid flesh and warm skin, her hair soft as dreams against his face.
"Okay?" she asked softly.
Long fingers touched his chest and his nipple puckered, curly hairs around it rising.
"Okay," he said,
and sighed deeply. He kissed her forehead briefly and relaxed, blinking. His throat was dry as sand and his mouth felt sticky, but he was beginning to think coherently again.
"What time is it?"
He was in his own bed, and it was dim enough in the room to be evening, but that was because the door was closed and the windows covered. Something felt wrong about the light, the air. She pushed herself up off him, sweeping back the fall of red hair with one hand.
"It's a little past noon. I wouldn't have waked you up, but there's a man, and I don't know what to do about him."
She glanced in the direction of the big house and lowered her voice, though surely no one was near enough to hear her. "Da's sound asleep, and Mama too," she said, confirming this impression. "I don't want to wake them, even if I could." She smiled briefly, one corner of her long mouth curling up with her father's irony. "It would take gunpowder, I think. They're dead to the world." She turned away and reached for the pitcher on the table. The sound of water pouring fell on Roger's ear like rain on parched land, and he drained the offered cup in 3 gulps and held it out again.
"More, please."
"Man?" That was an improvement. He was making complete words again, and his capacity to think coherently was coming back. "He says his name is Thomas Christie. He's come to see Da. He says he was at Ardsmuir."
"Yeah?"
Roger drank the second cup more slowly, assembling his thoughts. Then he put down the cup and swung his legs out of bed, reaching for the discarded shirt that hung from the peg.
"Okay. Tell him I'll be there in a minute."
She kissed him briefly and left, pausing long enough to untack the hide over the window and let in a brilliant shaft of light and chilly air. He dressed slowly, his mind still pleasantly torpid. As he bent to dredge his stockings out from under the bed, though, something in the tumbled bedclothes caught his eye, just under the edge of the pillow. He reached out slowly and picked it up. The old wifey. The tiny fertility charm, its ancient pink stone smooth in the sun, surprisingly heavy in his hand.
"I'll be damned," he said aloud.
He stood staring at it for a moment, then bent and tucked it gently back beneath the pillow. Brianna had put the visitor in Jamie's study, what most of the tenants still called the speaker word room. Roger stopped for a moment in the corridor, checking to be sure all his bodily parts were present and attached. There hadn't been time to shave, but he'd combed his hair. There was a limit to what this Christie might expect, under the circumstances. 3 faces turned toward the door as he came in, surprising him. Bree hadn't thought to warn him that Christie had outriders. Still, the elder man, a square-set gentleman with trimly cut black hair streaked with grey, was obviously Thomas Christie. The dark-haired younger man was no more than 20, and just as obviously Christie's son.
"Mr. Christie."
He offered the older man his hand.
"I'm Roger Mackenzie. I'm married to Jamie Fraser's daughter. You've met my wife, I think."
Christie looked mildly surprised and looked over Roger's shoulder as though expecting Jamie to materialise behind him. Roger cleared his throat. His voice was still thick from sleep, and thus even more hoarse than it usually was.
"I'm afraid my father-in-law is not available at present. Could it be of service to you?"
Christie frowned at him, assessing his potential, then nodded slowly. He took Roger's hand and shook it firmly. To his astonishment, Roger felt something both familiar and grossly unexpected, the distinctive pressure against his knuckle of a Masonic greeting. He hadn't experienced that in years, and it was more reflex than reason that caused him to respond with what he hoped was the proper countersign. Evidently, it was satisfactory. Christie's severe expression eased slightly, and he let go.
"Perhaps you may, Mr. Mackenzie, perhaps you may," Christie said.
He fixed a piercing gaze on Roger.
"I wish to find land on which to settle with my family. And I was told that Mr. Fraser might feel himself in a position to put something suitable in my way." "That might be possible," Roger replied cautiously. "What the hell?" he thought.
Had Christie just been trying it on at adventure? Or had he a reason to expect that the sign would be recognised? If he did, that presumably meant that he knew Jamie Fraser would recognise it, and thought his son-in-law might as well. Jamie Fraser, a Freemason? The thought had never so much as crossed Roger's mind, and Jamie himself had certainly never spoken of it.
"Please, do sit down," he said abruptly, motioning to the visitors.
Christie's family, the son, and a girl who might be either Christie's daughter or the son's wife, had risen as well when Roger came in, standing behind the pater familias like attendants behind some visiting potentate. Feeling more than slightly self-conscious, Roger waved them back to their stools and sat down himself behind Jamie's desk. He plucked one of the quills from the blue salt-glazed jar, hoping this would make him seem more businesslike.
Christ, what questions ought he to ask a potential tenant? "Now then, Mr. Christie."
He smiled at them, conscious of his unshaven jaws.
"My wife says you were acquainted with my father-in-law in Scotland." "'In Ardsmuir prison,' Christy answered, darting Roger a sharp look as though daring him to make something of this. Roger cleared his throat again. Healed as it was, it tended still to be clogged and rasping for some time after rising. Christy appeared to take it as an adverse comment, however, and bristled slightly. He had thick brows and prominent eyes of a light yellowish-brown colour, and this, coupled with feathery, close-clipped dark hair and the lack of any visible neck, gave him the aspect of a large, irascible owl.
"'Jamie Fraser was a prisoner there as well,' he said. "'Surely you knew as much.'
"'Why, yes,' Roger said mildly. "'I understand that several of the men who are settled here on the ridge came from Ardsmuir.'
"'Who?'
Christy demanded, increasing the owlish impression.
"'The Lindsays. That's Kenny, Murdo and Evan,' Roger said, rubbing a hand over his brow to assist thought. "'Georgie Chisholm and Robert MacLeod. I think... Yes, I'm fairly sure Alex McNeil was from Ardsmuir, too.'
Christy had been following this list with close attention, like a barn owl keeping track of a rustling in the hay. Now he relaxed, settling his feathers, as Roger thought.
"'I know them,' he said, with an air of satisfaction. "'McNeil will vouch for my character, if that's needful.'
His tone strongly suggested that it shouldn't be. Roger had never seen Jamie interview a potential tenant, but he had heard Fraser talk to Claire about the ones he chose. Accordingly, he posed a few questions regarding Christie's more recent past, trying to balance courtesy with an attitude of authority and, he thought, managing it none too badly. Christie had been transported with the other prisoners, he said, but had been fortunate in having his indenture purchased by a plantation owner in South Carolina, who, upon finding that Christie possessed some learning, had made him schoolmaster to his own 6 children, taking fees from the nearby families for the privilege of sending their children also to be tutored by Christy. Once Christy's term of indenture had expired, he had agreed to remain working for wages.
"Really?"
Roger said, his interest in Christy increasing markedly.
"A schoolmaster, eh? It would please Bree no end to be able to resign her involuntary position as what she disparagingly termed Bo Peep."
And Christy looked more than capable of dealing with intransigent scholars.
"'What brings you here, then, Mr. Christy? It's some way from South Carolina.'
The man shrugged broad shoulders. He was road-worn and quite dusty, but his coat was of decent cloth, and he had sound shoes.
"'My wife died,' he said gruffly, "'of the influenza. So did Mr. Everett, the owner.' His heir did not require my services, and I did not wish to remain there without employment.
He shot Roger a piercing look under shaggy brows.
You said Mr. Fraser is not available. How long will it be until his return?
I couldn't see.
Roger tapped the end of the quill against his teeth, hesitating. In fact, he couldn't say how long Jamie might be incapacitated. When seen last night, he'd looked barely alive. Even if he recovered uneventfully, he could be ill for some time. And he hated to send Christy away or make him wait. It was late in the year and not much time to spare if the man and his family were to be settled for the winter. He glanced from Christy to his son, both sizable men and strong from the looks of them. Neither had the look of a drunkard or a lout, and both had the calloused palms that bespoke at least familiarity with manual labour. They had a woman to look after their domestic requirements. And after all, Masonic Brotherhood quite aside, Christy had been one of Jamie's Ardsmuir men. He knew that Jamie always made a special effort to find such men a place. Making a decision, Roger pulled out a clean sheet of paper and uncapped the inkwell. He cleared his throat once more.
"Very well, Mr. Christy. I think we can reach some accommodation."
To his pleased surprise, the study door opened and Brianna came in, carrying a tray of biscuits and beer. She cast down her eyes modestly as she set it on the desk, but he caught the flash of amusement she sent him under her lashes. He bent his head, smiling, and touched her wrist lightly in acknowledgement as she set out the mugs in front of him. The gesture reminded him of Christie's handshake, and he wondered whether Brianna knew anything about Jamie's history in that direction. He rather thought not,
Surely she would have mentioned it.
Brianna, say hello to our new tenants, he said with a nod at the Christies. Mr. Thomas Christie and my son, Alan, Christie said with a jerk of the head, and my daughter, Malva.
The son had none of his father's owlish look, being much fairer in aspect, with a broad, square, clean-shaven face, though he had the same feathery, tufted, dark hair. He nodded in silent acknowledgement of the introduction, eyes fixed on the refreshment. The girl, Malva, barely looked up, her hands folded modestly in her lap. Roger had the vague impression of a tallish girl, perhaps 17 or 18, neat in a dark blue dress and white kerch, with a soft frill of black curls just visible around the pale oval of her face. Another point in Christie's favour, Roger thought absently. Girls of marriageable age were rare. Pretty ones, still rarer. Malva Christie would likely have several offers before the spring planting. Bree nodded to each of them, looking at the girl with particular interest. Then a loud shriek came from the kitchen, and she fled with a murmured excuse.
"My son," Roger said in apology.
He lifted a mug of beer, offering it.
"Will you take a bit of refreshment, Mr. Christie?"
The tenant contracts were all kept in the left-hand drawer of the desk. He'd seen them and knew the general outlines. 50 acres would be granted outright, more land rented as needed, with provision for payment made according to individual situations. A little discussion over the beer and biscuits, and they had reached what seemed an adequate agreement. Completing the contract with a flourish, Roger signed his own name as agent for James Fraser and pushed the paper across the desk for Christie to sign. He felt a deep, pleasant glow of accomplishment. A sound tenant, and willing to pay half his quitrent by serving as schoolmaster for 5 months of the year. Jamie himself, Roger thought complacently, wouldn't have done better. Then he caught himself. No, Jamie would have taken one more step and seen the Christies offer not only hospitality, but lodging, a place to stay until they could achieve some shelter of their own. Not here, though. Not with Jamie ill and Claire occupied in nursing him. He thought for a moment, then stepped to the door and called for Lizzie.
"We've a new tenant come and his family, Avernian," he said, smiling at her anxious, willing mouse face. "This is Mr. Thomas Christie and his son and daughter. Can you ask your da, will he take them up to Evan Lindsay's cabin? It's near where they'll have their own land, and I'm thinking perhaps Evan and his wife have room for them to stay for a bit, until they can get a start on a place of their own."
"Oh, aye, Mr. Roger."
Lizzie bobbed a quick curtsy toward Christie, who acknowledged her with a small bow. Then she glanced at Roger, thin brows lifted.
"Will himself know about it, then?"
Roger felt a slight flush rise in his cheeks, but gave no sign of discomposure.
"That's all right," he said. "I'll be telling him so soon as he's feeling better."
"Mr. Fraser is ill. I'm sorry to hear it."
The unfamiliar soft voice came from behind, startling him, and he turned to find Malva Christie looking up at him in question. He hadn't taken much notice of her, but was now struck by the beauty of her eyes, an odd light grey, almond-shaped and luminous, and thickly fringed with long black lashes. Perhaps sooner than the spring planting, he thought, and coughed.
"Bitten by a snake," he said abruptly. "Not to worry, though, he's mending."
He thrust out a hand to Christie, ready this time for the secret grip.
"Welcome to Fraser's Ridge," he said. "I hope you and your family will be happy here."
Jamie was sitting up in bed, attended hand and foot by devoted women, and looking desperate in consequence. His face relaxed a little at sight of a fellow man, and he waved away his handmaidens. Lizzie, Massali, and Mrs. Bug left reluctantly, but Claire remained, busy with her bottles and blades. Roger moved to sit down on the bedfoot, only to be shooed off by Claire, who motioned him firmly to a stool before lifting the sheet to check matters beneath and be sure that his ill-advised gesture had caused no damage. "All right," she said at last, poking at the white cheesecloth dressings with an air of satisfaction. The maggots were back, evidently earning their keep. She straightened up and nodded to Roger. Like the Grand Vizier granting an audience with the Caliph of Baghdad, Roger thought, amused. He glanced at Jamie, who rolled his eyes upward, then gave Roger a small wry smile of greeting.
"How is it?" both of them said at once.
Roger smiled, and the corner of Jamie's mouth turned up. He gave a brief shrug.
"I'm alive," he said. "Mind, that doesn't prove you were right." "You're not."
"Right about what?" Claire asked, glancing up with curiosity from the bowl in her hands.
"Oh, a wee point of philosophy," Jamie told her, "regarding choice and chance."
She snorted. "I don't want to hear a word about it."
"Just as well. I'm no inclined to discuss such matters on nothing but bread and milk."
Jamie glanced with mild distaste at a bowl of that nourishing but squashy substance, sitting half-finished on the table at his side.
"So have you seen to the ulcer on the mule's leg then, Roger Mac?"
"I did," Claire told him. "It's healing very well. Roger's been busy interviewing new tenants."
"Why?"
Fraser's brows went up in interest.
"Aye. A man named Tom Christie and his family. He said he was at Ardsmuir with you."
For a split second, Roger felt as though all the air in the room had been removed by a vacuum, freezing everything. Fraser stared at him, expressionless. Then he nodded, his expression of pleasant interest restored as though by magic, and normal time resumed.
"Aye, I mind Tom Christie fine. Where's he been in the last 20 years?
Roger explained both Tom Christie's account of his wanderings and what accommodations had been reached for his tenancy.
"That will do very well," Jamie said approvingly, hearing of Christie's willingness to be schoolmaster. "Tell him he may use any of the books here, and ask him to make up a list of others he might need. I'll get Fergus to look about next time he's in Cross Creek or Wilmington."
The conversation moved on to more mundane affairs, and after a few minutes, Roger got up to take his leave. Everything seemed perfectly all right, and yet he felt obscurely uneasy. Surely he hadn't imagined that instant. Turning to close the door behind him, he saw that Jamie had folded his hands neatly on his chest and closed his eyes, if not yet asleep, effectively forbidding conversation. Claire was looking at her husband, her yellow hawk eyes narrowed in speculation. No, she'd seen it too. So he hadn't imagined it. What on earth was the matter with Tom Christie? Chapter 95. The Summer Dim. The next day, Roger closed the door behind him and stood on the porch for a moment, breathing the cold, bright air of the late morning. Late? Christ, it couldn't be more than 7:30, but it was a good deal later than he was accustomed to start the day. The sun had already drifted into the chestnut trees on the highest ridge, the curve of its flaming disk visible in silhouette through the last of the yellow leaves. The air still held the tang of blood, but there was no trace of the buffalo left beyond a dark patch in the flattened pumpkin vines. He glanced around, taking stock as he mentally made his list of chores for the day. Chickens scratched in the fall shabby yard, and he could hear a small group of hogs rooting for mast in the chestnut grove. He had the odd feeling that he'd left his work months or even years before, not days. The feeling of dislocation, so strong at first, had left him for quite a long time, but now it had come back again, stronger than before. If he closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again, surely he would find himself on the broad street in Oxford, the smell of auto exhaust in his nostrils, and the prospect of a peaceful morning's work among the dusty books of the Bodleian ahead. He smacked a hand against one thigh to dispel the feeling. Not today. This was the Ridge, not Oxford, and the work might be peaceful, but it would be done with hands, not head. There were trees to be girdled and hay to be gathered. Not the field hay, but the small wild patches scattered through the hills that would yield an armload here, an armload there, enough to allow the keeping of an extra cow through the winter. A hole in the roof of the smoke shed made by a falling tree branch, the roof to be mended and re-shingled, and the branch itself to be chopped for wood. A fresh privy hole to be dug before the ground froze or turned to mud. Flax to be chopped. Fence rails to split. Lizzie's spinning wheel to mend. He felt groggy and stupid, incapable of simple choice, let alone complex thought. He had slept enough, more than enough, to be physically recovered from the exhaustion of the last few days. But Thomas Christie and his family, coming on the heels of the desperate business of getting Jamie safely home, had taken all the mental energy he had. He glanced at the sky, a low sweep of mare's tails sketched against the sky. No rain for a bit. The roof could wait. He shrugged and scratched his scalp. Hay, then, and tree girdling. He stuffed a stone jar of ale and the packet of sandwiches Bree had made for him into his bag and went to fetch the hand scythe and hatchet. Walking began to rouse him. It was cold in the shadows under the pines, but the sun was now high enough to make itself felt whenever he walked through the bright patches. His muscles warmed and loosened with the exercise, and by the time he had climbed to the first of the high meadows, he'd begun to feel himself again, solidly embedded in the physical world of mountain and forest. The future had gone back to the world of dreams and memory, and he was once more present and accounted for.
"Good thing, too," he muttered to himself. "Don't want to be cutting off your foot."
He dropped the axe under a tree and bent to cut hay. It wasn't the soothing, monotonous labour of regular haying, where the big two-handed scythe laid the dry, rich grass in pleasing swathes across a field. This was at once rougher but easier work than involved grasping a clump of sprouting muley or bluestem with one hand, slicing the stalks near a root, and stuffing the handful of wild hay into the burlap sack he had brought. It took no great strength, but required attention rather than the mindless muscular effort of field haying. The grass clumps grew thickly all over this small break in the trees, but were interspersed with outcrops of granite, small bushes, decaying snags and brambles. It was soothing labour, and while it did require some watchfulness, soon enough his mind began to stray to other things. The things Jamie had told him out on the black mountainside under the stars. Some he had known, that there was bad feeling between Alex McNeil and Nelson McIver, and the cause of it, that one of Patrick Neary's sons was likely a thief, and what should be done about it, which land to sell, when, and to whom. Others he had had no inkling of. He pressed his lips tight together, thinking of Stephen Bonnet. And what should be done about Claire?
"If I'm dead, she must leave," Jamie had said,
rousing suddenly from a feverish stupor. He had gripped Roger's arm with surprising strength, his eyes burning dark.
"Send her. Make her go. You should all go if the bairn can pass. But she must go. Make her go to the stones."
"Why?" Roger had asked quietly.
"Why should she go?"
It was possible that Jamie was deranged by fever, not thinking clearly.
"It's a dangerous thing to go through the stones."
"It is dangerous for her here, without me."
Fraser's eyes had momentarily lost their sharp focus. The lines of his face relaxed in exhaustion. His eyes half closed, and he sagged back. Then, suddenly, his eyes opened again.
"She is an old one," he said. "They will kill her if they know."
Then his eyes had closed again, and he hadn't spoken again until the others had found them at daylight. Viewed now in the clear light of an autumn morning, safely removed from the whining wind and dancing flames of that lost night on the mountain, Roger was reasonably sure that Fraser had only been wandering in the mists of his fever, concerned for his wife muddled by phantoms that sprang from the poison in his blood. Still, Roger couldn't help but take notice.
"She is an old one."
Fraser had been speaking in English, which was too bad. Had it been Gaelic, his meaning would have been clearer. Roger would have known whether Jamie truly thought his wife was one of the fairy folk, or only a thoroughly human wise woman.
Surely he couldn't.
But he might. Even in Roger's own time, the belief in the others rang strongly, if less widely admitted, in the blood of the Highlands. Now? Fraser believed quite openly in ghosts, to say nothing of saints and angels. To Roger's cynical Presbyterian mind, there wasn't a great deal of difference between lighting candles to St. Genevieve and putting out a pan of milk for the fairies. On the other hand, he was uneasily aware that he would himself never have disturbed milk meant for the others, nor touched a charm hung over a cow byre or door lintel, and not only from respect for the person who'd placed it there. The work had warmed him thoroughly. His shirt was beginning to stick to his shoulders, and sweat trickled down his neck. He paused for a moment to drink from his water gourd and tie a rag round his brow as a sweatband. Fraser might just have a point, he thought. While the notion of himself or Brianna, even of Claire, as being Sheehanach, was laughable on the face of it. There was more than one face to it, wasn't there? They were different. Not everyone could travel through the stones, let alone did. And there were others. Gilles Duncan, the unknown traveller she had mentioned to Claire, the gentleman whose severed head Claire had found in the wilderness, silver fillings intact. The thought of that one made the hairs prickle on his forearms, sweat or no. Jamie had buried the head, with due respect and a brief prayer, on a hill near the house, the first inhabitant of the small, sun-filled clearing intended as the future cemetery of Fraser's Ridge. At Claire's insistence, he had marked the small grave with a rough chunk of granite, unlabeled, for what was there to say, but marbled with veins of green serpentine. Was Fraser right? You should all go back, if the bairn can pass. And if they didn't go back? Then some day they might all lie there in the sunny clearing together, himself, Brianna, Jemmy, each under a chunk of granite. The only difference was that each would bear a name. What on earth would they carve for dates, he wondered suddenly, and wiped the sweat from his jaw. Jemmy's would be no problem. But for the rest of them? There was the rub, of course. Or one of them. If the bairn can pass. If Claire's theory was right, and the ability to pass through the stones was a genetic trait, like eye colour or blood type, then 50-50 if Jemmy were Bonnet's child. Three chances out of four, or perhaps certainty, if he were Roger's. He hacked savagely at a clump of grass, not bothering to grasp it, and grain heads flew like shrapnel. Then he remembered the small pink figure underneath his pillow and breathed deep. And if it worked, if there were to be another child, one that was his for sure, by blood. Odds, 3 out of 4. Or perhaps another stone one day in the family graveyard. The bag was almost full, and there was no more hay worth the cutting here. Fetching the hatchet, he slung the bag across his shoulder and made his way downhill to the edge of the highest cornfield. It bore no more resemblance to the British cornfields he'd been used to than did the high meadows to a hayfield. Once a patch of virgin forest, the trees still stood black and dead against the pale blue sky. They had been girdled and left to die, the corn planted in the open spaces between them. It was the quickest way to clear land sufficiently for crops. With the trees dead, enough sunlight came through the leafless branches for the corn below. 1 or 2 years later, the dead tree roots would have rotted sufficiently to make it possible to push the trunks over, to be gradually cut for wood and hauled away. For now, though, they stood, an eerie band of black scarecrows spreading empty arms across the corn. The corn itself had been gathered. Flocks of mourning doves foraged for bugs among the litter of dry stalks, and a covey of bobwhite took fright at Roger's approach, scattering like a handful of marbles thrown across the ground. A ladder-backed woodpecker, secure above his head, uttered a brief shriek of startlement and paused in its hammering to inspect him before returning to its noisy excavations.
"You should be pleased," he said to the bird, setting down the bag and unlimbering the hatchet from his belt. "More bugs for you, aye?"
The dead trees were infested by myriad insects. Several woodpeckers could be found in any field of girdled trees, heads cocked to hear the subterranean scratchings of their burrowing prey.
"Sorry," he murmured under his breath to the tree he had selected.
It was ridiculous to feel pity for a tree, the more so in this sprawling wilderness, where saplings sprang out of the thawing earth with such spring vigour as to crack solid rock, and the mountains were so thickly blanketed with trees that the air itself was a smoky blue with their exhalations.
For that matter, the emotion wouldn't last longer than it took to begin the job.
By the time he reached the third tree, he would be sweating freely and cursing the awkwardness of the work. Still, he always approached the job with a faint reluctance, disliking the manner of it more than the result. Chopping down a tree for timber was straightforward. Girdling it seemed somehow mean-spirited, if practical. Leaving the tree to die slowly, unable to bring water from its roots above the ring of bare, exposed wood. It wasn't so unpleasant in the fall, at least, when the trees were dormant and leafless already. It must be rather like dying in their sleep, he thought. Or hoped. Chips of aromatic wood flew past his head as he chopped his way briskly around the big trunk and went on without pause to the next victim. Needless to say, he took care never to let anyone hear him apologise to a tree. Jamie always said a prayer for the animals he killed, but Roger doubted that he would regard a tree as anything other than fuel, building material, or sheer bloody obstruction. The woodpecker screeched suddenly overhead. Roger swung round to see what had caused the alarm, but relaxed at once, seeing the small, wiry figure of Kenny Lindsay approaching through the trees. It appeared that Lindsay had come on the same business. He flourished his own girdling knife in cordial greeting.
"Madame Vach, Asmurish," he shouted. "And what's this I hear that we've a newcomer?"
No longer even faintly surprised at the speed with which news passed over the mountain, Roger offered his ale jug to Lindsay and gave him the details of the new family.
"Christy is their name, is it?" Kenny asked. "Yes, Thomas Christy and his son and daughter. You'll know him. He was at Ardsmuir."
"Aye? Oh."
There it was again, that faint tremor of reaction at Christie's name.
"Christy," Kenny Lindsay repeated.
The tip of his tongue showed briefly, tasting the name.
I will."
"What's the matter with Christy?"
Roger demanded, feeling more uneasy by the minute.
"Matter?"
Kenny looked startled.
"Nothing's the matter with him, is there?" "No, I mean, you seemed a bit taken aback to hear his name. I wondered whether perhaps he was a known thief or a drunkard or the like."
Enlightenment spread across Kenny's stubbled face like sun on a morning meadow.
"Oh, aye, I take your meaning now. No, no, Christie's a decent enough sort, so far as I ken the man." "So far as you ken? Were you not at Ardsmuir together then? He said so."
"Och, aye, he was there right enough," Kenny agreed, but seemed still vaguely hesitant.
Additional prodding by Roger elicited nothing, though, save a shrug, and after a few moments they returned to the cutting, pausing only for the occasional swig of ale or water. The weather was cool, thank God, but working like that made the sweat run free, and at the end of the job Roger took a last drink and then poured the rest of his water over his head, gasping with the welcome chill on his heated skin.
"You'll come ben for a bit, Asmiarish."
Kenny laid down his axe and eased his back with a groan. He jerked his head toward the pines on the far side of the meadow.
"My wee house is just there. The wife's a war to sell her pork, but there's fresh buttermilk in the spring."
Roger nodded, smiling.
"I will then, Kenny. Thanks."
He went with Kenny to tend his beasts. Lindsay had 2 milch goats and a penned sow. Kenny fetched them water from a small nearby creek, while Roger stacked the hay and threw a forkful into the goat's manger.
"Nice pig,"
Roger said politely, waiting while Kenny poured cracked corn into the trough for the sow, a big, mottled creature with 1 ragged ear and a nasty look in her eye.
"Mean as a viper,
and nearly as fast," Kenny said, giving the pig a narrow look.
"Near as God Almighty took my hand off at the wrist yesterday. I meant to take her to McDoo's boar for breeding, but she wasn't inclined to go." "Not much you can do with a female who's not in the mood," Roger agreed.
Kenny wobbled his head from one side to the other, considering.
"Och, well, that's as maybe. There are ways to sweeten them, aye. That's a trick my brother Evan taught me."
He gave Roger a gap-toothed grin and nodded toward a barrel in the corner of the shed that gave off the sweet pungency of fermenting corn.
"Aye," Roger said, laughing. "Well, I hope it works then."
He had an involuntary vision of Kenny and his imposing wife, Rosamond, in bed together, and wondered in passing whether alcohol played much part in their unlikely marriage.
"Oh, it'll work," Kenny said with confidence. "She's a terror for the sour mash, is that one. Trouble is, if you give her enough to improve her disposition, she canna walk just so very well. We'll need to bring the boar to her instead when MacDoo is on his feet."
"Is she in season? I'll bring the boar tomorrow," Roger said, feeling reckless.
Kenny looked startled, but then nodded, pleased.
"Aye, that's kind of Smearit."
He paused a moment, then added casually,
"I hope MacDoo is on his feet soon, then. Will he be well enough to have met Tom Christie?"
"He hasn't met him, no, but I told him."
"Oh. Oh, well, that's fine, isn't it?"
Roger narrowed his eyes, but Kenny looked away. His sense of unease about Christie persisted, and seized by a sudden impulse, Roger leaned across the hay and grasped Kenny by the hand, startling the older man considerably. He gave the squeeze, the tap on the knuckle, and then let go. Kenny gawked at him, blinking in the beam of sunlight from the door. Finally, he set down the empty pail, carefully wiped his hand on his ragged kilt, and offered it formally to Roger. When he let go, they were still friendly, but the situation between them had altered very subtly.
"Christie too," Roger observed, and Kenny nodded.
"Oh, aye, all of us."
"All of you, Ardsmuir, and Jamie?"
He felt a sense of astonishment at the thought. Kenny nodded again, bending to pick up his bucket.
"Oh, aye, it was MacDoo started it. You didn't, Ken?"
No point in prevarication. He shook his head, dismissing the matter. He'd mention it to Jamie when he saw him, assuming Jamie was in any shape to be questioned then. He fixed Kenny with a direct look.
"So then, about Christie, is there anything wrong about the man?"
Lindsay's earlier constraint had disappeared, now that it was no longer a matter of discussing a Masonic brother with an outsider. He shook his head.
"Och, no. It was only I was a bit surprised to see him here. He didn't quite get on so well with MacDoo, is all. If he had another place to go, I wouldn't have thought he'd seek out Fraser Ridge."
Roger was momentarily surprised by the revelation that there was someone from Ardsmuir who didn't think the sun shone out of Jamie Fraser's arse. Though on consideration, there was no reason why this shouldn't be so. God knew the man was quite as capable of making enemies as friends.
"Why?"
What he was asking was plain. Kenny looked about the goat shed as though seeking escape, but Roger stood between him and the door.
"No great matter," he said, finally,
shoulders slumping in capitulation.
"Only Christie's a Protestant, see?"
"Aye, I see," Roger said very dryly.
"But he was put in with the Jacobite prisoners. So was there trouble in Ardsmuir over it? Is that what you're telling me?"
Likely enough, he reflected. In his own time, there was no love lost between the Catholics and the stern Scottish sons of John Knox and his ilk. Nothing Scots like better than a wee spot of religious warfare. And if you got right down to it, that's what the entire Jacobite cause had been. Take a few staunch Calvinists, convinced that if they didn't tuck their blankets tight, the Pope would nip down the chimney and bite their toes, and bang them up in a prison cheek by jowl with men who prayed out loud to the Virgin Mary.
Aye, he could see it. Football riots would be nothing to it, numbers being equal. How did he come to be in Ardsmuir, then? Christie, I mean.
Kenny looked surprised.
Oh, he was a Jacobite. Arrested with the rest after Culloden, tried and imprisoned.
A Protestant Jacobite?
It wasn't impossible, or even far-fetched. Politics made stranger bedfellows than that, and always had. It was unusual, though. Kenny heaved a sigh, glancing toward the horizon where the sun was slowly sinking into the pines.
Come along inside, then, Mackenzie. If Tom Christie's come to the ridge, I suppose it's best someone tells you all about it. If I hurry myself, you'll be in time for your supper.
This ends Disc 39. The Fiery Cross, Disc 40.
Rosamond wasn't at home, but the buttermilk was cool in the well, as advertised. Stools fetched and the buttermilk poured, Kenny Lindsay was as good as his word and started in businesslike fashion. Christie was a lowlander, Kenny said. Mackenzie would have gathered as much. From Edinburgh. At the time of the rising, Christie had been a merchant in the city with a good business newly inherited from a hard-working father. Tom Christie was far from lazy himself and determined to set up for a gentleman. With this in mind, and Prince Charlach's army occupying the city, Christie had put on his best suit of clothes and gone calling on O'Sullivan, the Irishman who had charge of the army commissary.
Nobody kens what passed between them other than words, but when Christie came out he had a contract to victual the Highland army and an invitation to dance at Holyrood that night.
Kenny took a long drink of sweet buttermilk and set down the cup, his moustache thickly coated with white. He nodded wisely at Roger.
We heard what they were like, those bulls at the palace. MacDoo told us of them time and again. The great gallery with the portraits of all the kings of Scotland, and the hearths of blue Dutch tile big enough to roast an ox. The prince, and all the great folk who come to see him dressed in silks and laces. And the food, sweet Jesus, such food as he tell about.
Kenny's eyes grew round and dreamy, remembering the descriptions heard on an empty stomach. His tongue came out and absently licked the buttermilk from his upper lip. Then he shook himself back to the present.
Well, so, he said matter-of-factly, when the army left Edinburgh, Christie come along, whether it was to mind his investment or that he meant to keep himself in the prince's eye, I canna say.
Roger noted privately that the notion of Christie's having acted from patriotic motives wasn't on Kenny Lindsay's list of possibilities. Whether from prudence or ambition, whatever his reasons, Christie had stayed, and stayed too long. He had left the army at Nairn the day before Culloden, and started back toward Edinburgh, driving one of the commissary wagons.
If he'd left the wagon and ridden on one of the horses, he might have made it, Kenny said cynically. But no, he ran smack into a sackful of Campbells. Government troops, aye?
Roger nodded.
I heard tell as he tried to pass himself off as a peddler, but he'd taken a load of corn from a farmhouse on that road, and the farmer swore himself purple that Christie'd been in his yard no more than 3 days before, wi' a white cockade on his breast. So they took him, and that was that.
Christie had gone first to Berwick Prison, and then, for reasons known only to the Crown, to Ardsmuir, where he had arrived a year before Jamie Fraser.
I came at the same time.
Kenny peered into his empty mug, then reached for the pitcher.
It was an old prison, half falling down, but they'd not used it for some years. When the Crown decided to reopen it, they brought men from here and from there, maybe 150 men all told. Mostly convicted Jacobites. The odd thief and a murderer or two.
Kenny grinned suddenly, and Roger couldn't help smiling in response. Kenny was no great storyteller, but he spoke with such simple vividness that Roger had no trouble seeing the scene he described, the soot-streaked stones and the ragged men. Men from all over Scotland, ripped from home, deprived of kin and companions, thrown like bits of rubbish into a heap of compost, where filth, starvation, and close quarters generated a heat of rot that broke down both sensibility and civilness. Small groups had formed, for protection or for the comfort of society, and there was constant conflict between one group and another. They banged to and fro like pebbles in the surf, bruising each other, and now and then crushing some hapless individual who got in between.
It's food and warmth, aye? Kenny said dispassionately. There's naught else to care for in a place like that.
Among the groups had been a small obdurate knot of Calvinists headed by Thomas Christie. Mindful of their own, they shared food and blankets, defended each other, and behaved with a dour self-righteousness that roused the Catholics to fury.
If one of us was to catch a fire, now and then someone would, being pushed into the hearth while sleeping. They wouldna piss on him to put it out, Kenny said, shaking his head. They wouldna be stealing food, to be sure, but they would stand in the corner and pray out loud, rattling on and on about whoremongers and usurers and idolaters and the lot, and making damn sure we kent who was meant by it. And then came MacDhu.
The late autumn sun was sinking. Kenny's stubbled face was blurred with shadow, but Roger could see the slight softening that came across it, relaxing the grimness of expression that accompanied Lindsay's reminiscence.
"Something like the Second Coming, was it?" Roger said.
He spoke half under his breath and was surprised when Kenny laughed.
"Only if you mean some of us kent Hamish Rue already. No, man, they'd brought him by boot. You'll ken Jamie Roy doesn't take to boots, aye?" "I'd heard something of the sort," Roger answered dryly. "Whatever you heard, it's true," Kenny assured him, grinning. "He staggered into the cell, green as a lass, vomited in the corner, then crawled under a bench and stayed there for the next day or two."
Upon his emergence, Fraser had kept quiet for a time, watching to see who was who and what was what. But he was a gentleman born, and had been both a laird and a fierce warrior, a man much respected among the Highlanders. The men deferred to him naturally, seeking his opinion, asking his judgment, and the weaker sheltering in his presence.
"And that griped Tom Christie's arse like a saddle gall," Kenny said, nodding wisely. "See, he'd got to thinking as how he was the biggest frog in the pond, aye?"
Kenny ducked his chin and puffed his throat, popping his eyes in illustration, and Roger burst out laughing.
"Aye, I see. And he didn't care for the competition, was that it?"
Kenny nodded offhand.
"It wouldn't have been so bad, maybe, save that half his wee band of Salvationers started creeping off from their prayers to hear MacDhu tell stories. But the main thing was the new governor."
Bogle, the prison's original governor, had left, replaced by Colonel Harry Quarry. Quarry was a relatively young man, but an experienced soldier who had fought at Falkirk and at Culloden. Unlike his predecessor, he viewed the prisoners under his command with a certain respect, and he knew Jamie Fraser by repute, regarding him as an honourable, if defeated, foe.
"Quarry had MacDhu brought up to see him soon after he took command at Ardsmuir. I couldn't see what happened between them, but soon it was a matter of course. Once a week the guards would come and take MacDhu off to shave and wash himself, and he would go take a bit of supper with Quarry and speak to him of whatever was needed."
"And Tom Christie didn't like that either," Roger guessed.
He was forming a comprehensive picture of Christie: ambitious, intelligent, and envious. Competent himself, but lacking Fraser's fortunate birth and skill at warfare, advantages that a self-made merchant with social aspirations might well have resented, even before the catastrophe of Culloden. Roger felt a certain sneaking sympathy for Christie. Jamie Fraser was stiff competition for the merely mortal. Kenny shook his head and tilted back to drain his cup. He set it down with a sigh of repletion, raising his brows with a gesture toward the jug. Roger waved a hand, dismissing it.
No more, thanks. "But the Freemasons, how did that happen? You said it was to do with Christie."
The light was nearly gone. He would have to walk home in the dark, but that was no matter. His curiosity wouldn't let him leave without learning what had happened. Kenny grunted, rearranging his kilt over his thighs. Hospitality was all very well, but he had chores to do as well. Still, courtesy was courtesy, and he liked the thrush for himself. Not only that, he was MacDhu's good son.
"I will," he shrugged, resigning himself. "No, Christie didn't like it a bit, that MacDhu should be the great one, when he felt it his own place by right."
He cast a shrewd glance at Roger, assessing.
"I dinna think you kent what it might cost to be a chief in a place like that, not till later. But that's not to do with it."
He flapped a hand, waving off irrelevancy.
"The thing was, Christie was a chief himself, only not just so good at it as was MacDhu. But there were those who listened to him, and not only the Godnaggers."
If Roger was a trifle taken aback at hearing this characterization of his co-religionists, he disregarded it in his eagerness to hear more.
I saw. There was trouble again.
Kenny shrugged again. Small things, aye, but you could see it happening. Shifts and schisms, the small faults and fractures that result when two